Education. Fascinating question, which I think takes me a bit too far afield from the course topic, but there's all sorts of interesting ideas that you can find on Andrew Odlisko's webpage. He's the director of the Center for Digital Technology, which is at the University of Minnesota, I believe, and they have all sorts of involvements in projects related to the distribution of information, and in particular on Odlisko's webpage, that's O-D-L-Y-Z-K-O. You can find some fascinating essays on what exactly publication means, how science moves forward, etc. And then there's lots of other people who have comments about the topic, but although I have my own impressions of what's going on, I think that would probably take me an hour to go through, so maybe I should pop back to course material. Were there other questions about cryptography? Okay, I thought since there were a couple questions about using elliptic curves for signatures, I should briefly say the fastest elliptic curve-based signature system best non-RSA signature, subject, of course, to the caveat that there's lots of research into new public key systems all the time. When I say non-RSA, I mean if you don't care terribly about verification speed, then these are very good signatures to use. The signature system is basically Schnorr's system in 1989, although he was doing exponentiation, and I'm going to just translate exponentiation to elliptic curves. I'm not sure who was the first person to do this with Schnorr's system, probably early 90s. This is elliptic curves plus Schnorr's 1989 signature system, substantially improving an earlier idea by El-Gamal. What Schnorr said was that your secret key looks just like in curve 25519. In fact, if you're a little bit careful, you can reuse the same key for signatures and for Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Your public key, instead of using the curve 25519 notation, let me try to highlight the elliptic curve points here. Your public key is, 9 to the e. 9 is some standard base point, and, instead of exponentiation, I've got your exponent times that standard point 9, and you take the x-coordinate as usual. This is what you get if you compute curve 25519 of e without a second argument. The standard second argument is 9, where, 9 is the pair 9 comma something. You never have to bother computing the something. Well, the something is something that is pre-computed. It's just a completely standard number. This is a 32-byte public key, 255-bit number. And then the signatures satisfy the following equation. Let me see if I can get this right. The signatures look like a triple consisting of the message, and then the signature has two pieces, which are R and S, satisfying some equation, and the equation, if I get it right, is going to be that R is the hash of the x-coordinate of something a little tricky, and M is going to show up in a moment. H here is a hash function. Doesn't have to be a big output hash function. I'll get back to that in a moment. Take the x-coordinate of, how about S times 9 minus R times the public key, R times E times 9. So what I've written down is S times 9. Now, S is something that if you see a signature, you can multiply S by 9 yourself. And then R times the public key. Well, you're only given the x-coordinate of the public key, and there has to be a standard way to translate from the x-coordinate into a particular choice of the two y-coordinates to make this minus operation work, but that's easily specified, and then E times 9 is easily computed from the x-coordinate of E times 9, just solving a quadratic equation modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19. Take that point times R, take S times the standard point 9, subtract those, take the x-coordinate. This is a little more complicated than just doing the x-coordinate of S times 9, or the x-coordinate of something times something. You have to take two somethings and subtract the multiples. It takes a little more time, but it's not substantially harder. Then hash that together with M, and that's it. Can you find an R that satisfies this? Yes, you can, which is why I have a few more lines to fill in here. But just to emphasize what the verifier sees, the verifier has this S, which is, okay, something to multiply by 9, a 255-bit number. He has an R, which shows up, as you observe, in two places, and the R is actually, Schnorr's system is frequently quoted as producing another 255, 256-bit number, the hash just as long as the curve X and Y coordinates. So that would make R 256 bits and S 256 bits for a total of 512 bits, 64 bytes in a signature. In fact, Schnorr proposed having a half size H, saying we don't need H to have 256 bits of output, say we could have 128, or he was scaling down in security level. The number of bits of output of H in Schnorr's system was actually half the length of the number of elliptic curve bits. The number of H bits was your security level, number of elliptic curve bits was double your security level. And that resists all known attacks, although I don't like squeezing H quite that much. Using, say, a 128-bit H allows similar kinds of attacks to using a 128-bit key in a secret key cipher. But, all right, that's what Schnorr proposed has either way quite short signatures, even if you pump this up to a 256-bit H, which is way beyond what we need to resist attacks. You have 256 bits for R, 256 bits for S, total of 64 bytes for the signature on top of M. Now you asked about how do you find this R, and here's what the signer does. The signer, given the message M, does a little bit of pre-computation which doesn't depend on M. The signer signer computes a uniform random F and multiplies that by 9. And then R is going to be F9 minus RE9. That's going to be F times 9, which means that R is the hash of the x-coordinate of F times 9. And that's what can be done before looking at M, and then hash it together with M. Take, say, SHA-256 of the x-coordinate of F times 9. There's a curve 25519 computation, comma M. And then what about S? Well, now that we see what R is, you can easily solve for S because it just has to be S times 9 minus R times E times 9 is F times 9, which is easily achieved by taking S to be F plus RE. To be precise, you don't want to leak information here by just revealing that integer which says roughly how big F and RE is. This is F plus RE modulo the order of 9. I think of the addition of F there as encrypting the secret R times E. And it has to be encrypted in the usual one-time pad kind of way. Add some F that you never reuse. The F has to be sufficiently random mod the order of 9, which is something close to 2 to the 255. It's just fine to take a uniform random 256-bit F and take that plus R times E mod the order of 9, which again is, actually it's something like 2 to the 252 plus a little bit, or 2 to the 251 plus a little bit, but very close to a power of 2. So if F is between 0 and 2 to the 256 minus 1, then F plus RE encrypts RE modulo of the order of 9, and now you can easily see F equals F plus RE means S times 9 minus R times E times 9 is F times 9. So the signature equation works. All right, this system has held up just fine since 89, and there's lots of reasons to believe that it's secure. This offers quite short keys, quite short signatures, although not quite the shortest we have, but for reasonably fast systems, it's the shortest signatures that we have. And the time for signing, the time for verification, both look like, well, a little bit more complicated than doing a curve 25519 computation, but you don't have to do anything particularly tricky. When people are deploying these systems, this elliptic curve type signature system, they often forget about the option of not using signatures at all, setting up secure channels. You can see that the sender and receiver costs here are very much like the cost of setting up a secure channel with curve 25519. Now, the advantage of setting up a secure channel is you can send any number of messages practically for free. Well, at some point you start noticing the cost for each message, but if you have quite a few messages to send, if you have two messages to send, then you can share your curve 25519 computation across those two messages. As opposed to here, the receiver however many receivers there are, have to do another exponentiation, another scalar multiplication on an elliptic curve for each message, which is certainly more expensive once a receiver is receiving more than one message from a sender. On the other hand, from the sender's perspective, the sender gets to broadcast the signature once for each receiver. The total cost here is clearly, once you have more than one message between your typical sender-receiver pair, the total cost is clearly more than setting up a secure channel. Lots of situations people should be doing secure channels instead of, so Diffie-Hellman key exchange, the major course topics 1, 2, 3, instead of doing signatures. On the other hand, the sender cost, if that's the most important thing to minimize, is very small in the system. The sender just has to do this computation of RNS and then send out the MRS to all the receivers. Depending on the number of messages, number of receivers, here the signer, the sender, has to do something for each message. As opposed to setting up a secure channel, the sender has to do something comparable for each receiver. If there's a lot of receivers, not so many messages, then this minimizes the sender cost. But always keep in mind the possibility of throwing away signatures and doing something like elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman key exchange instead. All right, the side of signatures that I find most fascinating is the performance extremes where this system is not good enough because we really do need to reduce the receiver cost. We want to have faster verification without maybe giving up on the other nice features. We don't want to just blow up our signatures to huge lengths. We don't want to spend a lot of time transmitting, loading the signatures from RAM and loading them from the network. We also don't want to have huge keys, but a lot of situations, the critical operation is the verification time, what each receiver has to do. For me, the big challenge problem there is DNS security, where even convincing somebody to deploy 768-bit RSA-type keys or DSA-type keys for the domain name system, you get people complaining about the performance. They have their caches handling 10,000 requests a second and just can't keep up, at least with their current software. So this motivates looking once again at RSA systems, and where I left off last time was Rabin's improvements to the system. Rabin had several critical improvements to the 1977 RSA system. One of them was introducing hashing, which finally made a secure system. And then one of them was reducing the exponent dramatically from some big random number, as you see in the RSA paper or in Martin Gardner's article on the topic, reducing it down to an exponent of 2, which makes Rabin's signature equation look like S squared is supposed to be congruent, mod your public key PQ, to the hash of your message, S squared minus hash of M. This is a multiple of PQ. Your signed message is M, S. Your public key is P times Q. The secrets are the primes P and Q. And this obviously has a very low verification time compared to computing a big power of S modulo PQ. It, however, has a clear deficiency, which is where I left off at the end of last time, which is that it doesn't work. Most messages M you can't sign. So there's a big problem here, which is that most choices of the hash of M, most H's, little h, between 0 and PQ minus 1, don't have an S. If you're the signer and you know the primes P and Q and you can hope to solve equations, polynomial equations, mod P and mod Q, or mod the product, then you still can't solve S squared being H of M mod PQ because there just is no F. Most H's have no square root mod PQ. Only about half of all numbers have a square root mod P, and only about half have a square root mod Q. Overall, only about a quarter of the numbers have square roots mod PQ. So, Rabin said, all in the same brilliant technical report, that you should randomize the message M instead of signing m, you insert some random number before m, which is kind of what you'd imagine the user doing at a higher level. If you told them, okay, sorry, I can't sign that message, no square root exists, you're going to have to sign a different message. Then the receiver comes back and says, okay, how about I tweak the message a bit? Can you sign this one? Nope, sorry, try another one. How about this one? Oh yeah, I can sign that one. So Raven's new equation was s squared minus the hash of r comma m being 0 mod the public key pq. S is a square root of the hash, a randomized hash now of the message, mod pq, and the signed message is now m and r and s. What the signer does is the signer chooses a random r, the signer tries, I'll say, approximately 4 random r's, each r has about a quarter chance of working, signer tries about 4 random r's until finding one for which the square root exists, square root mod pq. Which, of course, makes your signatures 4 times more expensive on average, and at a variable time, if you have some real-time constraint on your signatures, which is something I haven't talked about very much, then if you're really worried about the latency of your signing, not just on average, but in the worst case, then you really don't like this because you could be spending 8 times or 12 times or 50 times as much. If you say you have a pool of 8 bits in R, if you say that R is going to be 8 bits long, 256 possibilities, that's enough to basically guarantee that, yes, there will be a square root mod pq of one of the 256 numbers you write down. But that could be taking 64 times longer to sign than you expected, and if you have a real-time constraint, must sign now, then, well, users might notice that you've suddenly taken a lot longer. Anyway, the average performance here is 4 times as long to sign, 4 times as many square roots as you would have had with the previous systems. This signing slowdown was fixed by Williams in 1980. And did I want to put in more comments about verification speed before? Now let's just jump to Williams. What Williams said was, hey, you know, us number theorists know all about square roots mod pq, and it's true that not everything has a square root mod pq, but everything, if you just tweak it a little bit, if you tweak it to one of 4 possibilities, depending on P and Q, then you can easily figure out a square root of one of those 4. So Williams proposed sticking in a couple of tweaks to the hash, which I'll call E and F, along with the R and S. Now, what are E and F? Well, E is something you multiply by S or by the hash. It's a plus or minus 1, figuring that if you try H and minus H, one of them has a better chance of, well, between 2 of them, you have a better chance of finding a square root than just 1. And F is either 1 or 2, so let me write those down first. E is just 1 or minus 1. F is 1 or 2. M is your message. R is some string. And S is the number modulo PQ, which satisfies the equation E times F times S squared minus the hash H of RM is a multiple of PQ. And then on the side, let me stick in some restrictions on P and Q that make this choice of F, 1 or 2, always work. P is 3 plus some, 3 plus 8Z. P is 3 plus a multiple of 8, and Q is 7 plus a multiple of 8. Under those restrictions from quadratic reciprocity, you easily see that plus or minus 1 or plus or minus 2 times something always gives you a square. So taking H and dividing by the E and F, dividing by the possible plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, one of those 4 numbers at least has to be a square. If you run into an H for which you have a factor in common with P and Q, then maybe more than one of them has a square, but okay, that doesn't actually happen. You'd have to be very lucky to run into a hash value that gives you a factorization of P times Q by having a factor in common with P times Q. So this is Williams' system, and this means that the first R always works. It speeds up signing by a factor of 4 compared to Raven's system without noticeably slowing down the time to verify. Okay, we have to maybe negate S squared and double it, shift it, but that's trivial compared to all the other arithmetic here. Now the first R always works. All you have to do as a signer is exactly the computation that I started the course with, computing a square root mod PQ, and that, assuming you use the Chinese remainder theorem speed up, the signer simply has to compute, let's see, a square root mod P, which is done as a P plus 1 over 4. That sounds like a reasonable power to compute modulo P. Something like that is going to give a square root modulo P, and then a square root modulo Q. And let me not forget the time to compute H, which, if your message is long, that's the dominating time here. But let's assume messages are short, so we're more worried about the number theoretic part of the system. And then what else does the signer have to do? Well, there's a little extra combination of the P and Q, and then things like figuring out whether actually you need to stick in a plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, let's just say a little extra bits, but nothing too serious. In Williams' original description of the system, for convenience, he said, well, you should compute some Jacobi symbols to see whether your square root needs the plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2 in there. And, well, people just mindlessly copying Williams' description said, okay, you have to do these Jacobi symbol computations, which, for a number theorist, well, it's not a serious effort compared to doing everything else, but for a programmer who hasn't seen Jacobi symbols before, they might sound like, yikes, what are you supposed to be doing there? I copied down a quote here from one cryptographic standard comparing RSA to Radon-Williams and saying, RSA signature generation has a code size and speed advantage since there is no need to compute the Jacobi symbol. Which is why I'm writing here, scary Jacobi symbols. Yikes, it's so much effort to compute the Jacobi symbol. Now, if you ask any number theorist, if anybody had bothered to ask Hugh Williams or anybody else looking at the system, hey, I don't want to compute Jacobi symbols, what do I do? Then the instant answer is, well, you don't have to bother. You can trivially skip the Jacobi symbols because Jacobi symbols just fall out of your square root computations, and if you need a 1 or 2 or minus 1, minus 2, then you can easily figure that out after trying your square roots instead of before. So, okay, if you read Williams' paper, he says Jacobi symbols, but if you simply ask, how do I avoid the Jacobi symbols, then you trivially write down the answer. It's not difficult to modify the system to not have Jacobi symbol computations, and I guess the people writing these comments and standards never actually asked the number theorist. Sometimes I wonder, how is it possible for, say, the people designing systems and the people implementing the systems and the users to have such apparent conflict? And I think back to examples like this where people just don't seem to talk to each other. And well, the people who know that you can trivially get Jacobi symbols out of doing a square root computation and therefore figure out your square root of number or minus a number mod p and so on, somehow those people weren't asked by the people writing the standards. But okay, anyway, if you're interested in the Radon-Williams system and somebody tells you, oh my god, Jacobi symbols, then just say, no, 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 you don't have to compute Jacobi symbols. I want to say a little bit more about the costs of signatures and the cost of verification, but first, let me say something about the length of R. Clearly, in Williams' system, since the first R always works, you don't need the R. The reason that Radon stuck it in there was to make the signature system work, because the first R doesn't always work, and, well, for Williams, it does always work. So you could reduce R to 0 bits instead of, say, 8 bits or 256 bits, whatever length of R you might think is appropriate. But there's lots of people, including me, who recommend using a longer R. I recommend 128 bits. And actually, Radon, if you look at his paper, then you first see that he's actually recommending, well, back in the old days of low security levels, a 60-bit R. And clearly, he was thinking about something beyond having enough R's to guarantee that your 1/4 chance repeated across those R's is going to give you a square root. 60 bits in R. He must have had something else in mind. 2 to the 60 choices of R is clearly overkill. And what he had in mind was the idea that by randomizing the H input, you make life more difficult for the attacker. Now, even without that randomized input, nobody has an attack on the system, but it still feels like, if you consider attacks, then it feels like randomized hashing is something that just eliminates vast classes of attacks. So having a big R as first proposed in the same tech report by Raven, and then also in Schnorr's analysis of how long the H should be, he was relying on the same fact that the H inputs are randomized there, 1989 Schnorr. And you can find lots of more recent papers. There's lots of discussion in a paper by Pernille and Van Aarschot, I think I'm getting that right, from 1995. And then lots of more recent papers on randomized hashing, sometimes reinventing the old stuff. But okay, it's clear even from the old papers that sticking R into the hash means that you don't have to worry so much about, for instance, collisions in H. Suppose that somebody finds two messages. I said if somebody finds a message M and a message M prime that collide under H and somehow convinces the signer to sign one of them, then he suddenly has a forgery of the other one, even if the signer would never have signed that other one. But if the signer sticks a random number, big random number, in front of each message, that doesn't work anymore. Even if the signer is convinced to sign one of the messages, having M and M prime collide under the hash function doesn't mean that RM and R prime M prime or anything else M prime collide under the hash function. It seems that you reduce pressure on H and in particular allow smaller, faster functions H. It seems that if you stick the R in, then you're allowing, for instance, MD5 to be a perfectly suitable hash function. Well, for Raven, you need to produce 2,048 bits of output, but in all these systems, you don't have to have such a slow H as, say, producing a really well-mangled 256 or more bits of output. You can get away with smaller, simpler hash functions H, and thanks to the R, the attacker still doesn't know what to do with these systems. Now, again, this is a vague idea which nobody really has justification for. There's some notion that attacks will be stopped by this. There's some limited types of security proofs that say, well, with random numbers, the proofs get easier and we don't know how to prove things without. In the end, we just don't have attacks either way. We just have this intuitive idea that sticking a random number into the hash function is good. And some examples of hash functions that seem to have been broken without randomization but are not broken with randomization. And based on that, the cost of sticking in a random number, 128 bits, is just, okay, generating the number, which I'll get to in a moment, and then transmitting it, and that's only 16 bytes compared to the 100 or 200 that I was talking about before. Question?
Do you think it would be a good idea to add randomization to hash functions
going forward? Excuse me. Would it be a good idea to randomize hash functions? Well, in some sense, you can just stick a random number into any hash function. There's some criticism. This is what the Pernille article is about and a lot of the newer work. Now that MD5 has been broken in the sense of finding collisions, lots of people are thinking, okay, what do we do to fix this? And there's some rather, I would say, overstated arguments that we should randomize hash functions in particular ways to use in signature systems, and anybody who uses zero bits for their random R is just crazy. And I don't want to overstate the level of the argument here, but there's certainly lots of people who say, yes, we should just build this into the hash functions. One of the proposals for using existing non-randomized hash functions, well, you could just insert an R in front of your message and hash that. Or one of the better proposals, I thought about this, and even though I think the argument for it is overstated, it does seem to annoy the attacker in ways that I wouldn't want to try to quantify. If you take the R and add it to each block of the message, if you repeat R, take R, 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 or maybe do a more complicated code starting from R instead of a repetition code, but even repetition seems to have some nice features. You take R, 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 add that to your message M, and then apply your typical hash function. That has at least some limited theoretical reasons for thinking that it protects some types of hash functions better than others. Again, everything's very conjectural, and I don't want to overstate the argument here, but it does seem like a good idea to randomize the functions, either building that into our description of the hash functions or by doing something with the R like what I just described on top of an existing hash function. And I don't know what's going to happen in hash function research, but I'm willing to say that it seems that our faster hash functions H are somewhat protected by randomization, and that we don't have to move up to slower functions H, which in the picture I've been drawing of the speeds here, you might say, wait a minute, we don't even notice the time to compute H, but your picture of that will change once we get to verification of signatures. And there, I think there really is a serious argument for using randomization. I'll get to verification pretty soon now. Did I answer your question? Okay. For generating the random bits here, there are lots of reasonable ways to generate random numbers. One of the better ways was proposed in 97 by Barwood and independently by Wigley. February, March 97, they proposed to generate the 128 random bits of R actually deterministically, which sounds strange. What does it mean to generate random bits deterministically? Well, what they said was to generate them secretly, generate the, I'll put random in quotes now, generate the random bits, whatever bits you need for R, as a secret function of your message. The secret being a signer, sender secret function of M. For example, I've been throwing away Salsa 20 and Poly 1305 and Diffie-Hellman even from the description of signatures, but let's toss them back in. You could, say, use Salsa 20 as a way to generate bits starting from Poly 1305 of M using some secret that the sender has. Now, I can't use R and S anymore because I have those for my R and S inside a signature, but let me just say there's another secret that the signer has, and it uses that secret with Poly 1305, applies that to M, uses Salsa 20 to mangle the result in some incomprehensible way. Here, there's no message number, there's no N coming into this, there's just some secrets in M, so if you feed in the same M again, you get the same random bits out, you get the same R, the same signature, and that makes some theoreticians a little bit happier, and as a practical matter, it means that, well, if you're generating signatures, you don't have to ask somebody else for your random bits, you just go through your comfortable cryptographic operations to generate bits that nobody can predict without knowing the secret. Nobody can predict what those bits are as a function of M. If you generate random bits in another way, that's okay. Again, this particular approach to generating bits, it's low cost, and it's something where there's some reasons to think it's a little better than the other approaches out there. So everything that I'm recommending here is something where I can't say, okay, I'm sure this speeds things up, I'm sure it improves security for a given speed level, but it seems like a good idea, and I speculate, and lots of people are speculating, that you should do things this way. Okay, to try to say why the theoreticians like these things would take me pretty far afield, but those of you who listened to the Menezes talk in the previous workshop heard something along the lines of this, how there's some slightly better theorems, which it's questionable exactly what they mean, but there's some slightly better theorems taking advantage of having a big R and having random bits actually generated deterministically. All right. I have a little bit more to say before I talk about verification speed. Namely, one difference between the system I've described, the Raven-Williams system, and the characterization I gave of the performance of the system at the beginning is clearly I'm missing something here. I've got my public key being P times Q, which is 2048 bits, and I said that fits into 88 bytes. So how does that work? compressing keys, which might sound crazy because keys are just random. You have a random P, random Q. Well, there's some restrictions because they're prime, but that only makes them effectively a few bits less randomness, and then their product has 2048 bits of randomness. How could you possibly compress that to significantly less than 2048 bits? Well, here's the trick. There's the well-known part of it, and then there's recent improvement. Let me start from, suppose I generate a public key. I generate my P0 and Q0, and I publish the product, my public key, P0, Q0. There's no compression going on here. The first public key, the one that I, as system designer, publish, that's something that everybody just has to write that down. Because I say, I'm special, write down my key. But every other user's key is going to be compressed as follows. You, another user of the system, starting from my key, you can come up with your own primes, P1 and Q1, say, that share half of their bits with P0 times Q0. I mean, if you multiply P1 times Q1 together, the product shares half of its bits. Let me write this down carefully. If you take the floor of P1 times Q1, your public key, divided by 2 to the 1024, then that's the same as the floor of P0 Q0 divided by 2 to the 1024. Before saying how to do this, which is quite easy, let me say the impact. If every user generates their secret P1 and Q1 in this way, then everybody's got the same top half, the same first 1024 bits of their public keys. Because P1, Q1, if you throw away the bottom 1024 bits, is the same as throwing away 1024 bits from P0, Q0. And, well, that means you just have to transmit the bottom 1024 bits. Let me talk about the algorithmic side of this and then the recent improvement by Coppersmith and then come back to the consequences to justify this claim about what you can do generating numbers P1 and Q1 with this property. All you do is you choose a random P1, uniform, random, in whatever appropriate range, and then you choose Q1, to be approximately P0 times Q0 divided by P1. And then, okay, P1 and Q1 have to be prime, so you repeat. If you don't have a prime, or say 7 mod 8, or whatever the restrictions were on your P1 and Q1, each secret key has some number of rules. Well, I've listed the rules before. P is 3 plus a multiple of 8, Q is 7 plus a multiple of 8. P and Q should be in particular ranges. I just said they're all supposed to be 2048-bit products, but let's say P is in some range and Q is in some range, and again, both of them have to be prime. Ignoring the repetition part of this, which happens, say, 1,000 times, the P1 and Q1 here, why do they have 1024 bits of their product in common with P0 times Q0? Well, how close is Q1 going to be to this ratio? If you take an integer Q1 as close as possible to P0 Q0 divided by P1, then, well, it's going to be within 1 or so. I mean, an integer Q1 close to this real number is going to be within a half, is the closest you can guarantee. And then P0 Q0 divided by P1 is a 2048-bit number. Each of the P's and Q's is 1024 bits. If you take the product 2048 divided by the 1024-bit P1, then you get a 1024-bit Q1. Which, okay, you have to round up and down to Q1 being within one of that, and then if you multiply by P1, P1 has 1024 bits, and now you've got a gap of something on the scale of 2 to the 1024, which is what this floor says. And okay, you should check that you're in exactly the right range, that P1 times Q1 is exactly between 2 to the 1024 times the desired floor here, and that plus 2 to the 1024 minus 1. All right, so you can easily generate P1 and Q1 just by choosing a P1 and then seeing whether Q1 works. Of course, if you check your P1 to see whether it's prime before you look at Q1, then you can try to save some time here. There's all sorts of things to say about it, depending on how you tweak the numbers here. You can try to reduce the 1,000 or so tries down to several dozens of tries. the numbers that pop into my head are, say, 4,000 tries is reasonable for generating numbers the way that I said, and if you work at it, you can get it down to 100 or so tries. But we don't care about key generation. It's something that each signer, each sender does once every now and then. Even the most extreme key regeneration guidelines will say you're supposed to regenerate your key every month, and that's just not a problem, even if you spend a minute doing this kind of computation. All right. You can do better than this. And the better is by Coppersmith in 2003. I bumped into him at a meeting and asked him, hey, it would be nice for key generation if we could generate three primes that have, say, two-thirds of their product being shared with the product of another three. You're given some P0, Q0, and suppose you're given two-thirds of bits of P0, Q0, R0. Can you find three primes, P1, Q1, R1, so that they share two-thirds of the bits instead of half the bits? And I thought that was the right question, even though it became clear later that that was completely the wrong question. He came back to me the next morning and said, you know, you can just do two primes and get two-thirds of the bits. And I said, what? And, well, so he explained it to me. And here's how it works. You generate a P1 and Q1, which you're going to throw away later because they're not close enough. Maybe I should say what better means, but I'll do that at the end of this. Start with P1 and Q1. And now do a very small lattice basis reduction. Find, let's say, 350-bit numbers, delta and epsilon, so that if you take delta times Q1 plus epsilon times P1, then that is close to, and I'll quantify this in a moment, close to the difference between, I think what I want here, let me just calculate briefly, I think I want P0, Q0, minus P1, Q1. And if I got that backwards, then I'll recalculate in a moment. So what are we looking at here? First of all, P0, Q0 minus P1, Q1. That's a difference in numbers which, by construction, those are within 2 to the 1024. Here's a 1024-bit number. What's going on with delta Q1 plus epsilon P1? Well, Q1 and P1 are each 1024-bit numbers. And if you multiply them by 350-bit numbers, it's about a third of 1024. They go up to four-thirds of 1024 bits. 1024 plus 350 bits. And now if you imagine searching through all 2 to the 700 possibilities of delta and epsilon and looking at this, this big number and then asking how many small ones are there, how close can you get to this 1024-bit number, then, well, you get random kind of differences as delta and epsilon vary. And out of all those 1024 plus 350-bit numbers, you get to effectively subtract 700 bits. The smallest one out of 2 to the 700 choices, the smallest one should be, and in fact, because of the linearity you can prove, is only about 1/2 to the 700th of the biggest. In other words, the close here is 2 to the 1024 times 2 to the 350 divided by 2 to the 700. So you can get the close here actually within 2 to the 1024 minus 350, something less than 2 to the 700. This is not something that requires a search through all the deltas and epsilons. Again, this is something easily done by a lattice basis reduction. If you know about Euclid's algorithm, you know a little bit about lattice basis reduction. You have to go a little bit further to do this, but, well, this is a standard problem, the closest vector problem in just two dimensions, and it's easily solved by the LLL algorithm very efficiently, or even simpler algorithms. This is actually not too hard to do, and, well, if you haven't seen lattice basis reduction, maybe this is motivation to learn about it. This is actually an easy computation. Once you have the delta and epsilon, now you simply define, compute, P2 to be P1 plus delta, and Q2 to be Q1 plus epsilon. And what does that mean for P2, Q2 versus P0, Q0? Well, if I multiply together P2, Q2, then this is, let's see, another tricky distributive law illustration P1 Q1 plus delta Q1 plus epsilon P1 plus delta epsilon. And that's very close to P0. How close is it? Delta Q1 plus epsilon P1, if I add P1 Q1 to it, it's very close to P0 Q0, the difference being only 700 bits. And then I add a delta epsilon, which is also about 700 bits. There's a high probability of achieving the difference between P2 Q2 and P0 Q0 being under 2 to the 700. Or let me be precise, what I want is P2 Q2 divided by 2 to the 704 is the same as P0 Q0 divided by 2 to the 704. Sometimes it doesn't exactly work because you got the close here plus the delta epsilon pushes you a little outside the range, but a large fraction of the time you end up with P2 Q2 and P0 Q0 are within 2 to the 704 of each other. They vary only at the bottom 704 bits, which is exactly the 88 bytes that I mentioned before. And now, having P2 and Q2, you throw away the P1 and Q1, never to be seen again, and keep the P2 and Q2 as your secret key. Suppose everybody does this, starting with one P0, Q0. All users generate their P and Q in this way, starting from the same P0, Q0. What's the result of this? All of the public keys, all the product PQ, the P2, Q2s here, are now sharing almost all their bits with P0, Q0. They vary only in the bottom 704 bits. The public keys of all the users vary only in the bottom 704 bits. The top 2048 minus 704, top 256 bytes minus 88 bytes are all shared. So you can't compress one key by itself, but you can compress a list of any number of keys. Let's compress every user's PQ down to, well, PQ mod 2 to the 704. Mod 2 to the 704, which, as I said, is 88 bytes. 88 bytes as advertised. And then you easily uncompress knowing the top of any of the public keys. It's just one completely standard piece of information. You uncompress trivially. It's instant computation of the uncompression using the top bits, standard top bits of P0, Q0, which are the same as the top bits of any other P times Q. So the fact you can compress to half size, well, it's something you can see in several articles, the down to one-third size, that's this newer result of Coppersmith. And this gets 2048 bit, which is 256 byte public keys, down to 88 byte public keys. Quite a significant reduction. Yeah?
I imagine that P0Q0 is a
88 key. Is there any reason P0Q0 has to be a real key? No. You can prove security of this system if you assume that P0Q0 was, in fact, a real key. So if somebody does go ahead and generate P0Q0, like as you were suggesting, a certificate authority, then you can prove that if you do this procedure sensibly and clarify what random means, you can prove that the distribution of any particular user's public key is exactly the distribution they would have gotten by not bothering with this in the first place. I mean, the whole procedure of generating P0Q0 and then P1Q1 and then P2Q2 produces a distribution of P2Q2 that is identical to the distribution of generating P and Q in the normal way. Therefore, the factorization difficulty and various breaking difficulties of these systems is the same. On the other hand, if someone were to generate a malicious P0Q0, then suddenly that proof breaks down. If you, instead of generating some secrets P0, Q0, if you just take digits of pi reversed or something, then that's just fine. We don't know any algorithms that are faster for those, faster for factoring PQs, which have their top bits being the reversed digits of pi. Those don't seem any easier to factor than anything else. We don't have a proof, but it would be inconceivable that pi was constructed to make our numbers particularly easy to factor if they started with those bits. If you chose, instead of generating P0 and Q0 and publishing this P0, Q0, if you published, say, a power of 2 and had everybody having their P's and Q's very close to a power of 2, that does make the numbers somewhat easier to factor, thanks to the special number field sieve. So it is important to have some sort of randomness, or at least not being chosen in a very, very bad way, that P0, Q0. And, well, what I've recommended for doing this type of system is that you take P0 and Q0 randomly from the RAND tables published in 1955, and then these are just tables of random digits, and everybody can verify that you've gone through that procedure. These tables have been very widely distributed, and it's maybe possible that they didn't generate those digits perfectly randomly, but it's not conceivable that they generated them to introduce any insecurity into this RSA type key generation. So, yeah, there's lots of different strategies for generating the number of which everybody's supposed to come close to that for their key. What gives us a security proof is actually generating P0, Q0 as a public key, but you can just not bother with the security proof. Any of the reasonable strategies for generating a string that people are supposed to match in their top bits, any of those strategies has a reasonable security conjecture, and the only thing that can go wrong, as far as we know, is you choose all those bits to be ones or something very patterned. Yeah. No, the person who knows P0 and Q0 is actually any user. So no, they don't have any advantage. I mean, the position of somebody who knows P0 and Q0 is exactly the same as the position of somebody who knows any of the other keys. In the security proof, you end up with each user is in a situation where, again, you could have, the result of this procedure, assuming that P0 and Q0 are generated randomly, and then the user follows through this generation of their P2, Q2. Then the distribution of P2, Q2 is exactly what you would expect if you reverse the whole thing and say, I start with P2 and Q2, where I'm not doing this crazy key generation procedure. I just make a normal P2 and Q2. I'm confident that those are hard to factor. And then somebody else can come up with P0 and Q0 that have the same distribution as here. So any attack that works starting from P0 and Q0 is also going to be an attack that works even if you generated P and Q, your own P and Q, in the normal way. Go ahead. Well, you can, yes, and all that matters for people generating their own P's and Q's is the product, P0, Q0, but you can do this, you can sort of leech off another user's public key if you like, or, yeah, they could generate P0 and Q0 and then publish those, and it doesn't make any difference for the security here, because that's something where, again, you could have had your P and Q, and then somebody else reverses the whole thing, and they come up with their P0, Q0 that matches P2, Q2 in all those bits, and then they publish P0 and Q0, and certainly that doesn't hurt the security of your P and Q. There are further, more subtle questions you could ask, even beyond these, okay, what's going on with security here? How does P0 and Q0 relate? You could also ask, okay, suppose we're trying to factor many public keys at the same time, and there's some gaps there between what we can prove about the difficulty of factoring many public keys versus factoring many public keys generated in the normal way. And in fact, there's even algorithms that suggest that we could factor lots of P's and Q's in a short interval faster than we could factor lots of P's and Q's that are spread apart. But these P's and Q's are all so big that we can't factor even one of them, so those attacks are not of any concern. And again, the security proofs say if you go through this, then your security against factoring and against any other attack, your security is the same for one user as if you had gone through the normal procedure. And then if you have many users, well, protecting yourself against multiple target attacks requires the same considerations for this system. Protecting yourself against, I mean, sort of provably protecting yourself against the best people can do requires your numbers to be as big, like 2048 bits, for this system as for generating P's and Q's in the normal way. There's all sorts of issues here, but the bottom line is, okay, I don't want to do a course on theoretical cryptanalysis, the bottom line is that the system with keys generated in this way has resisted attack and will continue to resist attack, so I feel just fine recommending it. Okay, other questions about this system? I still have some time, and I want to tell you the verification speeds and a little bit about compressing signatures. So let me just jump into that. So what I've highlighted as the most important speed constraint for these systems is the time for verification, and to repeat what we have as the critical computation, you are given a message M, you're given an E, let's do this in alphabetical order, you're given an E, which is 1 or minus 1, an F, which is 1 or 2. You're given a 2048-bit public key, P times Q. You're given an M, oops, that should have been earlier than PQ in alphabetical order. You're given R, which is some length, let's say 128 bits. And you're given an S, which is 2048 bits. And at this point, I hope I've copied all of the inputs correctly. And now your output, what you're trying to determine as a receiver is, does S satisfy its square is a hash of something modulo PQ? I'll use the bracket notation here for yes or no, 0 or 1, is S squared minus, oops, I forgot the E and F, is EF S squared minus the hash of R, M, is that a multiple of PQ? No question mark needed, bracket is question mark. So 1 if EF S squared is mod PQ the same as H of RM, 0 otherwise. You can, of course, start computing S squared. So here's the obvious approach. And I had this awful feeling I had something else that I wanted to insert here. What was I thinking? Ah, yes. Okay, so the obvious approach here is you start by squaring S. You compute S squared. And let's say, without going through the whole analysis, that this takes 5,000 CPU cycles. Depending, of course, on your CPU. It's substantially bigger than squaring a 256-bit number, which, as I mentioned, takes something like 100 CPU cycles. This is 8 times bigger numbers. You might expect 64 times more time, but well, here I've said 50 times more time, and that's using fancier multiplication algorithms. Possible to spend many, many hours talking about exactly how you square big numbers, more techniques than squaring small ones, but, well, I think today I want to focus on the higher level speedups. After computing S squared, you then multiply by E and multiply by F, and then you have to compute H. And now that could be a bottleneck. But let's just ignore the cost of that. Let's assume that M is short and that we're not spending much time computing this hash of it. Ignore the cost of those. I'll put a question mark there because actually, depending how complicated H is, once we get verification going really fast, the cost of computing H could be the biggest cost here. But, all right, ignoring that, you multiply by E, multiply by F, subtract off H, and let's just skip the cost of those and think about what looks like the hardest part of this, namely dividing EFS squared by PQ, dividing the difference here by PQ. Is the result divisible by PQ? One way to answer this is to divide it by PQ, which is more difficult than the divisions I've done previously in the course, because PQ is now not some nice number like 2 to the 255 minus 19 or 2 to the 130 minus 5. However, the same general strategy of doing divisions in the following rather abstract sense continues to work. You multiply your number that you want to divide by PQ, you multiply it by a reciprocal of PQ. Let's say that we have a real number, alpha, that's very close to 1 over pq. The difference, alpha minus 1 over pq, is, let's say, less than 1 over 2 to the 4096. pq is about 2 to the 2048. The reciprocal is about 2 to the minus 2048. And then alpha is about 2 to the minus 2048 with 2048 more bits of precision. Alpha is going to need 2048 bits of precision to give us an accurate result here. Let's assume that we're given the result here, which I wanted to give a name to. Let's call it X. I have a feeling it's bad. Y. Did I use Y? Yeah, Y is the result here. It's a 4096-bit result. S is 2048 bits. We square it, giving 4096 bits. Now, to divide it by PQ, we multiply it by alpha. What's the difference between alpha Y and alpha over, Y over PQ? Well, Y is less than 2 to the 4096, assuming here you have to be a little careful about your sizes of S, but assuming, maybe I should change it to 2 to the 4100. All right, then I'm definitely safe. Sorry about that. Multiplying that by Y is less than 2 to the 4100, so multiplying the whole thing by Y, this is certainly less than 1. And that means that the quotient Y over PQ, if you round that down to an integer, then that's very close to the product alpha Y. So you compute alpha times Y, which is about 2048 bits of precision times 2048 bits of precision. And then round that to an integer. Which is just throwing away the bottom half of the product, and then multiply the result by PQ, compute the quotient times PQ, which is another 2048 by 2048 bit multiplication, and finally, Y mod PQ is Y minus this multiple of PQ, except it might have been off depending on your rounding. You might be plus a PQ or minus a PQ. So you take Y minus this product and ask, is it minus PQ or 0 or PQ? Question mark. Depending on exactly how you choose the numbers, maybe you've got minus 2PQ or 2PQ, but okay, you go through the numerical analysis exactly how big your errors can be, and that tells you how many multiples of PQ you have to check for at the end. Basically, we've computed Y mod PQ by dividing Y by PQ, which we do by multiplying Y by some number with enough precision, some number that's reasonably close to the reciprocal of PQ, which means 2048 bits of precision. How much cost was there here? Well, we have two multiplications. Instead of a squaring of a 2048-bit number, beyond that, we have two multiplications of two 2048-bit numbers. And this costs maybe 8,000 cycles for each multiplication, adding significantly to the cost of the signature verification. You also have to figure out the alpha. When you're given the public key PQ, how do you divide by it? When we knew what a number was, we could easily figure out the reciprocal of, say, 2 to the 130 minus 5. But how do we figure out the reciprocal of some PQ? Sounds like a harder computation, and it is. You could use, for example, Newton's division method. It's not a bad method. But it's much better if you can just pre-compute that. If you can say, hey, I've seen that PQ before. I know how big PQ is. I know how big its reciprocal is. Well, how do you save all those reciprocals? Well, actually, all the PQs have about the same reciprocal. Because remember, they were all generated to be about the same number. Not exactly. But let's work through the details. Computing alpha, I claim, is not difficult. Especially since all the PQs, all the public keys, all the PQs are very close to, let's say, 2 to the 704 times C for a constant C. Everybody knows C. What is C? It is P0, Q0 divided by 2 to the 704, rounded down. This is exactly what's used for the compression. The decompression is, this is the constant you stick in front of PQ mod 2 to the 704. And the only thing you don't know is, if you have any public key PQ, it's 2 to the 704 C plus epsilon, where epsilon is between 0 and 2 to the 704 minus 1. If PQ is 2 to the 704 C plus a little bit, then the reciprocal of PQ is about the reciprocal of 2 to the 704 C. 1 over PQ is almost exactly, this is certainly precise enough for the alpha that I need, it's almost exactly 1 over 2 to the 704 C, which you only have to do once in some calculator, whatever system you like. And then subtract off the epsilon comes in as epsilon divided by the square of 2 to the 704 C. Epsilon divided by 2 to the 1408 C squared. If you do a complete series expansion of 1 over PQ, you see the next term is epsilon squared over something gigantic, and that's much less than 2 to the minus 4096. So this is a good enough approximation to 1 over PQ. You simply precompute the 1 over 2 to the 704C and 1 over 2 to the 1408C squared. Both of them to a reasonable amount of precision, both of them down to the 2 to the minus 4096 scale with some more because you're going to multiply by epsilon. But you work this out and you see that you need just a 704-bit by 704-bit multiplication. And again, to work out exactly what you should do, I'm just summarizing this. But you can say, here's exactly how big epsilon can be. Here's exactly how closely you compute these reciprocals of scaled multiples of C. And then once you have enough precision, you see that a 700-bit multiplication, a 704 by 704 multiplication, is enough to compute alpha. Definitely not a bottleneck compared to the 5,000, 8,000, 8,000 more cycles that we've looked at. The time for doing 2,048-bit multiplications is much more than the time for doing 700-bit multiplications. The more you compress your keys, the more benefit you get from this pre-computation that you could just do. If we could compress keys to one quarter size, you could just do a 512 by 512-bit multiplication. All right, so you can ignore the cost of computing alpha. It's still something. There's lots of steps here that take work to write software for, which is why I'm not quite done yet, but it's all doable, and looking at the speed in the end, we're not worried about the time to compute the reciprocal of PQ. It's certainly not as easy as writing down the reciprocal of 2 to the 130 minus 5, but it's still something reasonably doable. Imagine if C were 1 here, and you had 2 to the 704 plus a little bit. Then the reciprocal would be like power 2 minus the little bit. Just like work out the reciprocal of, well, 2 to the 130 minus 5, and you see the minus 5 times 2 to the minus 130 popping up. And this is just a generalization of that to arbitrary numbers. Okay, there's more to say about the speed of doing the verification, and I haven't even told you the biggest speed up, and then between that and compressing signatures, I think that'll be all the time I have left. So let me say the important speed-ups here. You can, first of all, ignore the bottom half of the multiplication of alpha times y. You can save time on the bottom half of alpha times y because you're just going to throw it away. And you save time on the top of the, once you have a result rounded to an integer, result times PQ, because you know the top half of it, and you're going to throw the top half of that product away, you know that the result times PQ is about equal to Y. And both of these, well, there's for the top some particularly cute speed-ups which I briefly referred to at the beginning of the course, the mod x speedups. And wow, if any of you are running into division bottlenecks, then be happy to chat with you about the mod x. But I don't think it's as much fun as the big improvement here in verification speed, which is to expand the signatures. If you're not too worried about bandwidth, then the signer, or anybody who wants to expand S to save time for the verifier, the signer can go ahead and figure out the thing that has to be multiplied by PQ. In other words, ST are supposed to satisfy E times S squared minus the hash value, let me just use little h for hash output, is equal to P times Q times T. A lot of our work here was figuring out what T was. And here I'm just going to say, communicate T. Let somebody else communicate T. Now, all right, there's two obvious advantages to this. For the verifier, which is all we care about right now. The first one is that someone else computed T. The signer or the intermediate person expanding S into S and T. And of course that saves time. But even more impressive is that what we're trying to verify, what you should be saying ooh and ah about, is that we just have a ring equation here. There's no more divisions, there's no more anything aside from additions, multiplications, ring operations. Verify a ring equation probabilistically. If you want to know whether EFS squared minus H minus PQT is zero, all you have to do is compute it mod a random prime. The verifier chooses a random, let's say V is our verification prime. Don't want to use R or P or Q, so V is a verification prime. And checks that EFS squared minus H minus PQT is congruent to zero modulo V. If, for example, V is a 100-bit prime, uniform random 100-bit prime, then the probability of this number being a multiple of V, being V times an integer, and being not equal to zero, is extremely small. What's the chance you choose a V that divides this 4,096-bit number? Well, if it's zero, then every V divides it. But if it's not zero, then it's divisible by only how many 100-bit primes can divide a 4,096-bit number? Only 40 of them. And there's way more than 40 100-bit primes. This probability is negligible. Or instead of a 100-bit prime, you can use several smaller primes. You might say, wait a minute, I don't even want to spend the time to generate smaller primes. Isn't that a bottleneck in this algorithm? But the verifier can reuse the V across any number of signature verifications. Verifier can reuse V for any number of signatures. As long as he doesn't tell V to anybody, then all his results are, except with negligible probability, all of his results are independent of what the choice of V is, and nobody can tell what V is, as long as he keeps it secret. Or he can use one V for, say, 100 signatures and then move on to another one, whatever you need to avoid the prime generation being a bottleneck. In general, probabilistic algorithms with this type of feature, once you've pumped up the probability of your right results being 1 minus epsilon, 1 minus negligible, then you can reuse your randomness for any number of iterations of this probabilistic algorithm. This is faster than any deterministic algorithm we know for verifying a ring equation. In general, if you're trying to check that some sequence of additions, multiplications is giving you zero, check it modulo a prime. And that's a very reliable test if you haven't told somebody in advance what the prime is. If you generate it after the fact, or you generate it and keep it secret so somebody doesn't know it, then they have no way to come up with a non-zero number that's divisible by your prime or by several smaller primes. What's the cost here? Well, you have to take S and PQ and T and H and reduce each of them modulo V. T mod V and H mod V, PQ mod V, and you could look for opportunities here for PQ, for instance. Part of that is something you already know, so you just have to reduce the epsilon part of it mod V, but okay, ignoring the little speed-ups. This is four divisions of 2048-bit numbers by 128, no, 100 is what I said for the size of V. Four divisions, instead of a squaring and some more work, something like the cost of two or three multiplications, maybe two multiplications, of 2048 by 2048-bit numbers. And this is clearly much, much less work. Plus, for your prime V, or each of the Vs, if you have several of them, you then have to compute S mod V squared minus dot, 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 and see whether the result is equal to zero, but this is fast since V is small. Fast since the numbers are small. The total time here is much less than the time for verification. The total, depending on your CPU, depending on sizes, I admit that the software that I have is for smaller sizes, so I'm guessing here that the result is about 2,000 cycles. Certainly much less than 10,000 or more that you would get from doing anything without this extra T. Unfortunately, at this point, you really start noticing the time to compute H. And this is where I haven't seen adequate research on this. I really want to know how fast your H can be. And lots of functions H that people write down are clearly overkill. Plus the time to compute H. Some of the fastest H's that I know, which are definitely less operations than what people typically recommend for this H, are thousands of cycles. So you really have to pay attention, even for a short message, you really have to pay attention to the H computation time here. The rest of the verification has become amazingly fast, and you can't reasonably assume that H time is negligible. All right. Subject to finishing software for this, this is the fastest verification that I know for RSA, Rabin-Williams type signatures. And if you're in a situation where there's tons of verification going on, even if H is fairly slow, certainly you can do this tens of thousands of times a second, even on a fairly slow computer. This is adequate for the most extreme performance situations I know of. If you're in a situation where you say, wait a minute, I don't want to have such a long T, I just want to have a short signature, I still don't want to really slow down verification to the Schnorr level, but I do want to have something that's not this, how many bytes, 500-something bytes of S and T. If you're, for instance, working with a DNS packet that has to fit into 512 bytes, you can fit S, but you can't fit S and T. And in other applications, you might want something even smaller. And so the last thing I want to say, and there was a brief question about this, so of the various topics, I figured this would be a good ending one. Last thing I wanted to say was how you can compress signatures. Another thing that sounds crazy, like compressing keys, but, well, here's how to do it. I think the paper might have been published by Blackenbacher only later, not sure about the 2003 date, but certainly on the web since 2003. So Blackenbacher's idea is the following. You compute the continued fraction, A0, A1, A2, etc., for FS divided by PQ. And what is a continued fraction? Well, these are supposed to be non-negative and pass the first one all positive integers, so that FS over PQ is A0 is FS over PQ plus a little bit, 1 over something. A0 is the first quotient in Euclid's algorithm. Take FS divided by PQ, A0 is the integer part of the quotient. Take the result, keep going in Euclid's algorithm, and then the quotients in Euclid's algorithm are exactly these A's, dot, dot, dot. A0 plus 1 over something that looks similar with A1 and so on. And then let's compress the signature S, well, the signed message, MEFRS, to MEFRD sub I. What is D sub I? Where there's two constraints on D sub I. One is that D sub I is a denominator in this continued fraction. What are denominators? Well, D sub I is the denominator of, keep going through A sub I, I guess that just fits down here, A0 plus 1 over A1 plus 1 over A2, etc., through A sub I. And what is I? Well, you take the largest I is maximal, with D sub I being compressed. D sub I being less than, let me be a little careful here, less than or equal to PQ divided by 2 to the 1023. So D sub I is less than, what is it, 2048 bits in PQ minus 1023 bits that I've taken away. This is some public constant. It's just C scaled appropriately. Find the biggest I so that D sub I is less than or equal to that, which means that D sub I is only half the size of S. Instead of 2048 bits, it's 1025 bits, and then the 1 bit is something where, ooh, I realized before when I said 128 bits, I meant to say 125 to leave room for the E bit and the F bit and for this bit, but okay, without worrying about a couple extra bits here and there, D sub I is only about 1024 bits instead of 2048. And amazingly, you can reconstruct S from D sub I. Or you can just go ahead and verify D sub I without even bothering to compute S. And the reason is that by continued fraction theory, if you have a numerator of the same continued fraction, let's call it C sub I, but all I care about is that there's some integer, C sub I, divided by D sub I. If you take away the fraction you started with, FS over PQ, then that is less than or equal to 1 over D sub I plus 1. General theorem, familiar for those of you who've seen continued fractions. And now multiplying this by, let's see, how about D sub I and PQ to get an integer on the left side? I'll get C sub I times PQ, something 0 mod PQ, minus, what I care about is F times S times D sub I. That's less than or equal to PQ divided by DI plus 1, but I being chosen so that DI is less than or equal to this and the next one is bigger, I is maximum with this condition, means DI plus 1 is bigger than PQ over 2 to the 1023, so the ratio is at most less than 2 to the 1023, PQ over DI plus 1. And that means if you square this, this integer, CI PQ minus FSDI squared, is less than 2 to the 2046, which is less than PQ. which I claim lets you reconstruct S from D sub I. What do we know about D? D sub I is non-zero. It's a non-zero integer. It's in the range 1, 2, etc. through 2 to the, how big can it be? 2 to the 1025 minus 1. With, what happens if you square D sub I? Okay, let me look at this FS D sub I. I claim that taking E times F times D sub I squared times H, that this is the square of an integer. This is exactly, take this integer, if I mod it by PQ, then this is exactly CIPQ minus FSDI squared. What's going on here? FSDI squared, that's F squared, S squared, DI squared. What did I write down that's different? I have an E and an F instead of F squared, and F squared is, if I take EFS squared, then moving an E over there, EFS squared is the same as H, DI squared is the same, F, well, I had F squared instead of an F, there's the F, and I had an E, which I popped in over here, so, okay, these are the same mod PQ, maybe not the most clear proof, but just stare at this until you believe they're the same mod PQ, and then this is the square of some integer. This is the square of an integer in the set, 0, 1 through 2 to the, how big was the integer again? 2 to the 1023 minus 1. How do you reconstruct S? Well, you compute this from D sub I, and now this integer is something you've computed, the absolute value of CIPQ minus FSDI. Ignoring the PQ, FSDI is the square root of this number. F is plus or minus DI inverse times F inverse times the square root of this number, square root of EFDI squared H mod PQ. And when I say those inverses, this is dividing by FDI mod PQ. DI inverse, well, Blackenbacher ignores the failure possibility in writing down this formula. DI inverse, DI is non-zero here. And the DI inverse is, well, it's something that presumably exists, but maybe D has a factor in common with P and Q, in which case, computing DI inverse, you know P or Q, and you can just compute S for yourself, so you have to modify this algorithm a little bit, but clearly, in every case, you get a satisfactory S, which, by playing with this, you see satisfies the signature equation, you get a satisfactory S out of D sub I. If you like, don't bother computing S. Once you've checked that D sub I is the square of an integer in this range, and that D is non-zero, then you know that S exists, and you know that you have a valid signature without even bothering to compute it. This doesn't slow down verification very much. Blackenbacher's idea, well, it's not quite as fast to do this computing DI squared and then multiplying it by H and then computing the result mod PQ. It's back to the level of computation I was talking about before, and you have to do a square root computation and then do, if you want to reconstruct S, a division. But after the square root computation, you know you have a valid signature. It's a little more work than the signature verification I started with, but it's really nice to be able to reduce D sub I to half its size if you're worried about the bandwidth. Okay, I'm going to allow myself the luxury of a few final comments about high-speed cryptography. Of course, those of you doing course projects, which I think is most of you, are going to be here in a week. Next Friday at 11 o'clock, we'll spend a few hours, morning and afternoon, chatting about course projects. And in the meantime, let me emphasize, feel free to send me email with any sorts of questions about the course projects over the weekend or through the beginning of next week, but we will meet again on next Friday. Yeah, I just have a few little comments here about what we've seen in the course. So conclusions, high-speed cryptography, of course, has to pay attention to the CPU. People get amazing slowdowns by not looking at what the CPU actually does. In the old days when the UltraSpark was popular, there were people who were trying to multiply with the UltraSpark's integer instructions that were something like 50 times slower than what you can do with floating point. Nowadays, the gaps are maybe only factors of 3 or 5, but high-speed cryptography certainly starts by paying attention to the CPU. Starts at the CPU level. And then goes beyond CPU-specific algorithm design, supercomputing, architecture, optimizing compilers, goes beyond that to choosing algorithms, which is what's special about cryptographic algorithm design. It continues to saying, okay, what algorithms are going to be fastest? What functions are going to be fastest? We can choose our function to gain speed. And so we choose our message authentication codes, like Poly 1305 or maybe something like UMAC. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? There's all sorts of good choices of stream ciphers. I've mentioned SALSA 20, but also a bunch of others. Lots of reasonable stream ciphers to use that certainly provide higher speed for better security guarantees. Well, we don't have any guarantees. We have conjectures, better security beliefs than what we have for, say, AES and counter mode. Continuing on to Diffie-Hellman functions, there's, well, I've illustrated curve 25519, but then it's clear that in the future, once we've generated safe parameters, that Genus 2 hyperelliptic curves will provide substantially better performance, and who knows what more could happen in the field. Again, Genus 2, with the latest results, is something like 1.5 times faster than the best we have for elliptic curves. Just a little parameter generation problem, but okay, state of the art is moving forward, and if you don't pay attention to your function, you can easily lose a factor of 3 there. And then, of course, there's signature systems. It's amazing the number of times that people will use RSA with exponent 3 and complain about the verification speed. And then somebody suggests Rabin-Williams, and they'll say, oh, well, is it really that much faster? There's the Jacobi symbol. And, well, choosing a sensible system and, if necessary, engineering the software so that people stop complaining about the non-existence of the software can really save a lot of time. And then high-speed cryptography keeps going. There's all sorts of higher-level protocols where I'm amazed the number of times I see people, for instance, signing and encrypting a bunch of messages from the same sender to the same receiver using public key encryption, public key signatures. It's an amazing waste of time compared to setting up a secure channel, which is faster than doing a single RSA decryption, for example, setting up a secure channel and then resorting to secret key cryptography. People will do all sorts of dumb things in their choices of protocols, not always, but often the biggest improvements you get are just by saying, excuse me, do you really have to be using public key encryption? Why don't you just do, say, Diffie-Hellman and reuse your shared secret? There's all sorts of higher level protocols where you should not stop with sensible choices of your systems, but how you put those systems together, the crypto systems and the public key encryption functions, while sharing secret sharing functions, Diffie-Hellman functions, signature systems, how do you put all these together into an internet protocol? That's something where, again, you have to choose a sensible protocol, and your choice really dictates the amount of time you take. By integrating what happens at all of these levels, hopefully we can make something that's fast enough for cryptography to be deployed everywhere on the internet, or at least more places than it's deployed now. My closing comment is, if you see something that's too slow, then don't be afraid to change it.